The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated May 25th, 2012. We'll begin with the main story section. The headline is J.P. Morgan's losses renew calls for reform. What happened? J.P. Morgan Chase suffered a $2.3 billion trading loss last week, handing supporters of stricter bank regulations renewed ammunition in the fight over financial reform, and leaving its star CEO, Jamie Dimon, with a rare black eye. The bank said the losses, which could rise to as much as $4 billion over the next year, stemmed from large bets on complex corporate bond derivatives, made mostly by a J.P. Morgan trader nicknamed the London Whale for his market-moving trades. Dimon, who has been a persistent and sharp critic of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms, blamed errors, sloppiness, and bad judgment for the losing strategy, but said the loss would be offset by about $4 billion in profits this quarter. Three bank officials, including Chief Investment Officer Ina Drew, resigned. Dimon acknowledged that the losses would build momentum for the Volcker Rule, a still undefined provision of financial reform that would prohibit banks from engaging in large speculative bets. Dimon said the bank's blunder comes at a very unfortunate and inopportune time and puts egg on our face. J.P. Morgan's embarrassing losses immediately became part of the presidential campaign. Presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney has joined congressional Republicans in vowing to repeal the Dodd-Frank reforms. President Obama said J.P. Morgan's losses illustrate why Wall Street reform is so important. Now here's what the editorials had to say. How little has changed since 2008, said USA Today. Banks continue to chase sky-high profits with casino-style betting on derivative markets, even after their recklessness caused a global financial implosion. J.P. Morgan can cover this latest loss, but what happens when the next supposedly savvy trader at a less profitable bank gets in dangerously over his head? The Volcker Rule has never looked more necessary, said the Washington Post. Jamie Dimon has arrogantly dismissed former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, who proposed the rule, as a man who doesn't understand capital markets. But last week's losses prove that banks themselves don't always fully understand their own complicated trading positions. Volcker is beginning to look like a prophet. Now here's what the columnist said. That's just not true, said Alan Sloan, also in the Washington Post. The Volcker Rule sounds wonderful and simple. Don't let banks use federally insured deposits for risky trades. But banks are so big and complex now that it will be nightmarishly difficult to enforce. It's not even clear that J.P. Morgan's losing trades would have violated it. Wall Street's critics are trying to make it a crime for a business to lose money, said Jonathan Macy in the Wall Street Journal. Nobody should care about J.P. Morgan's loss except its shareholders, who will barely feel a pinch given its $2.3 trillion in assets. This is a bank that emerged from the financial crisis largely unscathed, and it will learn quickly from this misstep. Losing $2 billion is a far better motivator than any rule Washington has proposed. Banks backed by taxpayer guarantees have no business making such bets, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Dimon, Wall Street's own point man for fighting financial reform, can't even explain how his bank just stumbled into a $2 billion loss, thereby providing a demonstration of why Wall Street does, in fact, need to be regulated. The fact that Diamonds Bank more or less invented risk management makes its losses all the more disturbing, said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. If J.P. Morgan can't police itself, no bank can. And no sensible regulator can ever trust the banks to self-regulate, especially as the memory of the financial crisis fades. No regulatory scheme can solve the fundamental problem here, said David Rohde in TheAtlantic.com. Since 2008, when the biggest banks caused a crisis that decimated the middle class, these banks have actually gotten bigger, with just five banks controlling $8.5 trillion in assets, equal to 56% of the nation's economy. These banks remain too big to fail and can arrogantly continue to take big risks and throw armies of lobbyists and lawyers at regulators. Smaller banks will be easier to regulate and foster more competition. Break up the big banks. The next item from the main story section, the GOP's shutdown dare. House Republicans set the stage this past week for another high-stakes confrontation with President Obama over government spending, demanding that food stamps and other social programs be cut to restore billions to the Pentagon budget. House Speaker John Boehner said that unless Democrats and the president agreed to deep spending cuts, his caucus would again refuse to vote to raise the debt ceiling when government borrowing next reaches it early in 2013. Boehner welcomed another battle over the debt limit as an action-forcing event. Last year's tense negotiations between Congress and Obama over the debt ceiling ended with $1.2 trillion in automatic sequestration spending cuts set to begin in January. But House Republicans acted last week to shield the Pentagon, passing a bill that would replace $55 billion in defense cuts with reductions in spending on food stamps, Medicaid, and financial regulation. What a week for Republican extremism, said the New York Times in an editorial. First, GOP legislators voted to cut food stamps for more than 2 million Americans to protect bloated military spending and unjustifiably low taxes for the rich. Then, having driven the government to the brink of default last year at the cost of its AAA credit rating, the GOP declared it wants to do it all over again. And why shouldn't they, said Ezra Klein in the WashingtonPost.com. After all, it worked out well for them last time. The GOP won $900 billion in spending cuts, sank President Obama's approval rating to below 40%, and, intentionally or not, set back the recovery, thus giving them a better chance of knocking Obama out of office. If this culture of brinksmanship is to the end, the debt ceiling needs to be taken off the table once and for all. The only question is how. The coming election will be a good start, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. We're trapped in this cycle of showdowns because the two parties offer such starkly contrasting visions of government. Let Republicans stand by their principle of fiscal restraint and let the Democrats preach the value of taxing the rich. Then let voters decide. Once they do, in November, we'll have a clearer sense of whether it's time to talk compromise again. The next article from the main story section this week is Greece in Political Chaos. Greece moved a step closer to exiting the euro this past week after sparring political parties failed to form a new government, rattling European markets and triggering another round of elections next month. No viable coalition emerged from the welter of far-left and far-right parties elected earlier this month amid widespread anti-austerity fervor. With the country stuck in political limbo, investors worried that Athens would be unable to make the $14 billion in further budget cuts required by the European Union International Monetary Fund bailout deal. That failure would halt the flow of financial aid to Greece, force it to withdraw from the eurozone, and return to the drachma. The uncertainty pushed the euro to a four-month low against the dollar and led depositors to withdraw at least $898 million from Greek banks. Europe is about to experience the mother of all bank runs, said Matthew O'Brien in the Atlantic.com. If Greece exits the euro, depositors in Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy will transfer their cash to safe countries like Germany. That capital flight will encourage international investors to start betting on a breakup, causing borrowing costs to soar and making the euro's collapse even more likely. That pain would soon cross the Atlantic, said Bradley Clapper in the Associated Press. Wall Street has trillions of dollars tied up in European banks, and if the euro implodes, cash-strapped U.S. financial firms will start limiting their lending. Thanks to Greece, Americans will find it harder to secure loans for business expansion and home mortgages. There's only one way to stop this cataclysm, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. The EU and the IMF must push back their austerity deadlines and let Greece form a government that can recommit to economic reform. Voters will only back centrist parties if European leaders stop demanding self-defeating budget cuts and instead support growth measures in Greece and other ailing economies. Failing that, Europe and the world will have no choice but to prepare for the worst. And now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the Week magazine. It's entitled, Romney, Does an Old Bullying Story Matter? Once a bully, always a bully, said Paul Begala in the DailyBeast.com. Last week's front page story in the Washington Post about the young Mitt Romney's bullying of a gay prep school classmate in 1965 raises serious questions about the man who seeks to become the most powerful person in the world. Romney, the Post revealed, became incensed when an effeminate classmate, John Lauber, returned to the wealthy prep school from vacation with bleached hair that hung down over one eye. He can't look like that, Romney told his pals. That's wrong. Just look at him. The tall, wealthy Romney then organized a posse of friends who held down the screaming, weeping Lauber while Romney chopped off the blonde locks with scissors. In a telling comment, said Amy Davidson in the NewYorker.com, Romney denied any memory of the attack, conceding with a chuckle that I participated in a lot of hijinks and pranks during high school. Is brutalizing a gay classmate merely a prank? Perhaps that same inability to see the world from anyone's perspective must be his own, explains why, as a Republican presidential candidate, this smugly privileged man opposes letting gays and lesbians marry their partners. Shame on the Washington Post, said the New York Post in an editorial. This irrelevant story, dredged up from nearly half a century ago, is conclusive proof that the mainstream media is complicit in Team Obama's ceaseless effort to distract voters from real issues, such as the economy. For some reason, the media never shows any interest in Barack Obama's admitted use of marijuana and cocaine in his teen years, or his later association with campus radicals, Marxists, and black liberation theologians. The Post story smells like a plant from the Obama campaign, said John Hayward in HumanEvents.com. What's far more relevant is Romney's demonstration of compassion in subsequent years. He's twice saved several people who were close to drowning in a lake at his summer home, and in 1996, he shut down Bain Capital and flew every employee to New York City to search for the missing 14-year-old daughter of an employee. Sure, people change, said Justin Rubin in HuffingtonPost.com, but the reason Romney's prep school bullying is so damaging is that it lines up well with the rest of what voters have learned about him. Mitt at 17 sounds like the same guy who got rich buying and breaking up companies and who recently said, I like being able to fire people. Mitt also has said, I'm not concerned about the very poor, and he wants to fund huge tax breaks for the already wealthy by slashing programs for the needy. In 1965 and in 2012, Romney has displayed a pronounced empathy deficit. Romney could change that perception, said Christian Hines in The Hill, if he were willing to talk about his Mormon religion. While working as a missionary in France, Romney was involved in a near-fatal car crash that changed his outlook on life. As a leader in the LDS Church, Romney performed many acts of kindness to fellow Mormons in trouble, acts detailed in a biography written by two Boston Globe reporters. Romney, however, has assiduously avoided a deeper personal discussion of his faith, so as not to trigger hostile scrutiny of Mormon theology and practices. So that leaves him with a dilemma: go into the election with a massive compassion gap between himself and Obama, or speak more openly of his beliefs. Option two would really put America's religious tolerance to the test. Now, from the controversy of the week, we will turn to the popular article entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for everyone on Earth after archaeologists found ancient Mayan calculations that indicate the world will last at least another 7,000 years, rather than end with a calendar cycle, concludes in December. It's like the odometer of a car, said anthropologist Anthony Aveni. The Maya just start over. It was a good week for attending your own funeral after Hamdi Hafez al-Nubi, a 28-year-old Egyptian, was declared dead but regained consciousness at his funeral. He celebrated with other attendees. And it was a good week for fighting injustice after Bill Wist of Wisconsin picketed a restaurant that asked him to leave its all-you-can-eat fish fry when he had 12 fillets. It's false advertising, said the 350-pound Wist. We asked for more fish and they refused to give us more fish. It was a bad week for butt dials after a report found that 3.9 million calls, or 40% of total calls, to New York City's 9/11 response system in 2010 came from inadvertent cell phone dials. It was a bad week for morons after the police department in Fort Lee, New Jersey, responded to a growing number of pedestrian injuries and deaths by issuing tickets with $85 fines for texting while jaywalking. In 1 month, 117 tickets have been issued. And it was a bad week for headbanging after Michael Åkerfeldt, the lead singer of Swedish death metal band Opeth, had to cancel a show in Minnesota when he cracked open his head on the tour bus while trying to retrieve fresh underwear from his suitcase. Åkerfeldt told fans, "Wish the story was more rock and roll, believe me." Now let's take a look at the People's section from the Week magazine for this week. The first article is entitled, Smith's Old-Fashioned Parenting. Patty Smith thinks modern parents aren't strict enough with their kids, said Stephanie Marsh in The Times in the UK. My daughter didn't have a cell phone till her 16th birthday, says the punk rock pioneer, and everyone in her school at 10 years old had a cell phone. I didn't think it was proper for a child. Her school was nearby, she was safe, and I didn't think it was a healthy thing to have that machine near her ear. Smith, who is now 65, often appeared on stage in the 1970s sporting secondhand clothes and matted hair, but she hates the way her kids' classmates come dressed to school. I found the laxity with which a lot of kids were being raised puzzling, she says. I thought that kids were dressing too provocatively for school and tried to talk to the other mothers about it. Other parents dismissed her concerns, saying they thought their children should be free to express themselves. But I didn't think that that was proper for school, says Smith. Just because I sing rock and roll doesn't mean I have no code as a human being or don't have concerns for my children. I found that other mothers were more interested in being their daughter's friend or rival than taking the position of a mother. The next article from the People's section is called The Man Who Guarded the Rock. George DeFincenzi spent 7 years guarding some of America's most dangerous criminals, said John O'Connor in the Financial Times. The former Navy engineer started working as a jail guard at Alcatraz in 1950 when he was 24 years old. I arrived at 9 a.m., and by 9:30 a.m., I had witnessed my first murder, he says. It was in the barbershop, and one inmate, Freddie Lee Thomas, was giving another, his lover, a haircut. All of a sudden, Thomas went after the other guy with a pair of shears. He got him in the heart and lungs. That was my introduction to Alcatraz. They went to electric clippers after that. DeFincenzi soon discovered that the jail's most infamous residents were among its best behaved. I knew the Birdman of Alcatraz, Robert Stroud, very well. He was a psychopath and a murderer, but I used to play checkers with him through the cell bars. He was very good. I don't think I ever beat him. George Machine Gun Kelly, the kidnapper, was also a model prisoner. DeFincenzi left the Rock in 1957 for a better job and now gives tours of the island prison. An ex-convict named Robert Cole Blue Luke works with me sometimes, he says. He was at Alcatraz for bank robbery while I was a guard. Now we are pretty good friends. And the next item from the People's section, Allman's brotherly love. Greg Allman thinks about his brother Dwayne every day, said Chris Talbot in the Associated Press. And sometimes the singer can feel the legendary rock guitarist watching over him. I can tell when he's there, man, Allman, 64, says of his former bandmate who died in a motorcycle accident in 1971. I'm not going to get all cosmic on you, but listen, he's there. The singer is still haunted by his final conversation with his older sibling when the two fought over some missing cocaine. The spat started when Allman gave his brother $100 to buy a gram but never got the drugs. Incensed, he snuck into Dwayne's house, found his stash, poured out about half a gram, and snorted it up. When Allman got home, Dwayne phoned and demanded to know if he had stolen the coke. Allman said that he hadn't. The last thing I ever said to my brother was an effing lie, man. Dwayne apologized and told Allman he loved him. I have thought of that lie every day of my life, and I just keep re-crucifying myself for it. I know that's not what he would want. Well, not for long, anyway. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me. We're going to the briefing section now, and the title of the article this week is Battleground Wisconsin. Governor Scott Walker faces a recall vote next month that will resonate throughout the nation. What is at stake? Why does Walker face a recall election? He triggered an ideological civil war over the power of labor unions. When the Republicans took office in 2011, he faced a two-year budget deficit of $3.6 billion. To help close the gap, Walker pushed the Scott Walker budget repair law through the state legislature, despite fierce resistance from Democrats. The law drastically curtailed collective bargaining rights for all state government employees except firefighters and police, forbade the collection of union dues by payroll deduction, and required public employees to devote from 7 to 13% of their salaries to help fund their health insurance and pensions. Conservatives hailed Walker's efforts to curtail the salaries and benefits of public worker unions, but unions throughout the nation were livid. In Wisconsin, pro-labor volunteers organized to recall Walker, gathering 900,939 petition signatures, about 360,000 more than they needed. As the June 5th recall vote approaches, passions are white hot. I've never seen a division in our state like this, said John Jurek, an assistant school principal in Milwaukee. I'm not talking to some of my friends because of it, he said. Does the election matter outside Wisconsin? There's no doubt about that. The recall, which pits Walker against Democratic primary winner Tom Barrett, is widely seen as a precursor to the 2012 presidential race and as a proxy for the national battle between small government conservatives and populist progressives. Walker is not alone in arguing that taxpayers can no longer afford to pay for the lavish benefits, pensions, and salaries of unionized government workers. Republican Governors Chris Christie of New Jersey and John Kasich of Ohio are among the many who have vigorously taken up the chorus. Mitt Romney calls Walker a hero. The Wisconsin governor has amassed a recall war chest of $25 million, at least 60% of it from out-of-state Republican donors, including casino mogul Sheldon Adelson and Amway founder Rich DeVos. We've spent a lot of money in Wisconsin, said conservative donor David Koch of Koch Industries. If the unions win the recall, there will be no stopping union power. Are the unions mobilized? Well, they see it as a crucial battle, though they are disappointed in the selection of Barrett in last week's Democratic primary. In his 8 years as Milwaukee's mayor, Barrett has frequently clashed with the city's public employee unions. National and state labor organizations plowed at least $4 million into the campaign of Barrett's primary opponent, Kathleen Falk, who put union demands at the center of her campaign, but Barrett's statewide visibility and broader campaign message prevailed. The unions are now preaching unity. All of the progressive elements, farmers that were in the fight, teachers that were in the fight, steel workers that were in the fight, everyone has unified behind Mr. Barrett, said United Steelworkers President Leo Girard. No wonder labor fears that a Walker win would inspire a nation wave of laws rolling back bargaining rights and benefits. Are labor rights still the main issue? They've become just part of a large partisan argument over how best to deal with budget deficits, jobs, and the economy. The irony is that collective bargaining, which was the instigation of all in all this, is fading into the background, says Marquette University pollster Charles Franklin. The Obama campaign, sidestepping the union issue last week, accused Walker of putting the very wealthy ahead of what's best for middle class. And Barrett, who lost to Walker by almost 6 percentage points in the 2010 gubernatorial election, prefers talking about jobs. Walker promised that his small government approach would lead to the creation of 250,000 jobs in Wisconsin in his 4-year term as governor. 2 years into it, only 5,900 new private sector jobs have materialized. But Walker says his pushback against the unions has already saved Wisconsin taxpayers more than $1 billion. Last week, the State Department of Revenue announced new projections that Wisconsin will have a small surplus by the end of 2013. Who will win? In recent polls, Walker has moved into a lead ranging from 5 to 9 points. Walker's support among Republicans is strong. 86% of GOP supporters back him, with only 63% of Wisconsin Democrats view Barrett favorably. Walker's opponents say now that they've settled on their candidate, it's a new game. The electorate is already highly polarized. Only 4% of voters say they haven't made up their minds. Both Democrats and Republicans, said University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee political scientist Mordecai Lee, have embraced Karl Rove's 2004 strategy, cubed, finding your niche demographic and getting them to vote. The result is that on June 6th, about half the state's voters will be triumphantly happy, while a slightly smaller percentage will be bitterly despondent. Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. for this past week. The very first one here is entitled, Breastfeeding Kids Until They're Age 4. And this was written by Liz Moyer in WSJ.com. Excuse me, but when did parent become a verb? Asked Liz Moyer. Everybody's hawking some new theory about how to raise kids so as to ensure their total self-actualization. The latest fad is attachment parenting, which Time used as an excuse last week to put a woman breastfeeding a 4-year-old on its cover. The idea is that your kids will thrive only if you take them into your bed, then spend every waking hour nurturing, cuddling, carrying, and breastfeeding them, even when they're old enough to pour themselves a glass of milk. This follows the Tiger Mom craze in which mothers berate their violin-playing straight-A children into becoming high-achieving automatons. And more recently, the French Mom model, magically producing impeccably behaved children who eat their leeks without complaint. Where does hyper-mommyism lead? I can easily see these moms as helicopter parents hovering over their kids' lives well into their teens and twenties. Perhaps we've forgotten something here. The goal of parenting is raising boys and girls to become competent, independent adults, not to turn them into proof of their control freak mommy's superiority. The next column is entitled The Healthiest State in the Nation by Mark Vanhoenacker in Slate.com. Why is Mitt Romney so ashamed of his years in Massachusetts? Asked Mark Vanhoenacker. The red states may sneer at the Bay State as Taxachusetts, a haven for arugula-munching aging hippies with universal health care. But by every economic, social, and educational standard, the nation's favorite punching bag is an exceptionally successful state. Its schools have produced the best scores on 4th and 8th grade reading and math tests, with the lowest gap between poor and wealthier kids. On average, our students even outperform those from Singapore and Japan. Thanks to Romney Care, we have the best rate of prenatal care, the lowest child mortality rate, and the lowest percentage of uninsured residents, 5% compared with 25% in Texas. Our life expectancy is 5 years higher than that of some of the red states, but what are the costs of producing this liberal paradise? None, apparently. Our divorce rate is among the nation's lowest. Once per capita income is the second highest, or our per capita income is the second highest in Massachusetts. Our unemployment rate is 6.5%, well below the national rate. Hey, Mitt, if America wants to be a healthy, smart, rich, globalized, high-tech powerhouse, we arguably have no better model than Massachusetts. And our third column this week is Where Race Remains Relevant by Eli Hager in the Washington Post. The civil rights movement is over, a piece of completed American history. That said, Eli Hager is the soundbite consensus of politicians and pundits who insist that this country has moved beyond the racial injustice of the past. Anyone who complains about the unequal status of African Americans in this view is guilty of playing the race card. To these folks I say, come visit rural Mississippi. The schools here where I teach 8th grade are as fundamentally separate and unequal as they were in the 1950s. White students are sent to prestigious private academies and have every opportunity to succeed, while the state's failing public schools are 95% black, churning out students who are functionally illiterate and destined for poverty or jail. Even my most imaginative and promising students will be unable to afford college, are unlikely to vote, and will not leave Mississippi. Their future lies in dirt-poor black neighborhoods of boarded-up stores, sky-high unemployment, and stillborn dreams. Here, the glorious age of color blindedness is a grotesque illusion. And now we will flip the magazine to the back of the Week magazine this week, and we'll take a look at the column entitled The Last Word. And the specific article this week is entitled I Was a Warehouse Wage Slave. Life in the online shopping, or rather online shipping business, says Mac McClellan, is nasty, brutish, and poorly paid. The place is immense, cold, cavernous, silent despite thousands of people quietly picking items or standing along the conveyors, quietly packing or box taping. Nothing noisy but the occasional whir of a passing forklift. I have just been hired as a picker, which means my job is to find, scan, place in a plastic tote, and send away via conveyor whatever item within the multiple stories of this several hundred thousand square foot warehouse my scanner tells me to. My scanner tells me in what exact section. There are 9 merchandise sections, so sprawling that there's a map attached to my ID badge of vast shelving systems the items reside. It also tells me how many seconds I should take to get there. Dallas Sector, Section 11, or Section Yellow, Row H34, Bin 22, Level D, Wearable Blanket, 20 seconds. At 5'9", I've got a decently long stride, and I cover the 20 steps and locate the exact shelving unit in the allotted time, only if I don't hesitate for a second and walk as fast as I can or even jog. Often as not, I miss my time target. I'm working for Amalgamated Product Giant Shipping Worldwide, Inc., which has ordered the exact number of humans from the temp agency to fill this week's orders if we work at top capacity. Lots of retailers use temporary help in peak season, and online ones are no exception. But lots of warehousing and distribution centers like this also use temps year-round. The Bureau of Labor Statistics found that more than 15% of pickers, packers, movers, and unloaders are temps. They make $3 less an hour on average than permanent workers, and they can be temporary for years. Always, they can be let go in an instant. Everyone in here is hustling. At the announcement to take one of our 2 15-minute breaks, we hustle even harder. We pickers close out the totes we're currently filling and send them away on the conveyor belt, then make our way as fast as we can with the rest of the masses across the long hall of concrete between wherever we are and the break room. But first we must pass through metal detectors, for which there is a line. We're required to be screened on our way out, though not on our way in. If we don't set off the metal detector and have to be taken aside and searched, we can run into the break room and try to find a seat among the long-ass rows of tables. We lose more time if we want to go to the bathroom. People who work at Amalgamated are always working this fast. Right now, because it's almost Black Friday and the start of the Christmas shopping season, there are just more of us doing it. Amalgamated has estimated that we pickers speedwalk an average of 12 miles a day on cold concrete, and the twinge in my legs blurs into the heavy soreness in my feet that complements the pinch in my hips when I crouch to the floor. The picker's shelving runs from the floor to 7 feet high or so to retrieve an iPad protective case, iPad anti-glare protector, iPad one-hand grip holder device, and dildos, really a staggering number of dildos. At lunch in the break room, mothers frantically call home. "Hi, baby," you can hear them say. Coos to children echo around the walls. Lunch is 29 minutes and 59 seconds. We've been reminded of this. Lunch is not 30 minutes and 1 second. That's a penalty point earning offense, and that includes the time to get through the metal detectors and using the disgustingly overcrowded bathroom. So we chew quickly and are often still chewing as we run back to our stations. Near the end of my third day, I get written up. I sent 2 of some product down the conveyor line when my scanner was only asking for 1. The product was boxed in 2s, so I should have opened the box and separated them, but I didn't notice because I was in a hurry. With an hour left in the day, I've already picked 800 items. Despite moving fast enough to get sloppy, my scanner tells me I'm fulfilling only 52% of my goal. A supervisor who is genuinely nice person comes by with a clipboard listing my numbers. She needs this job too, so she has no choice but to tell me something I have never been told in 19 years of school or at any of some dozen bad workplaces. "You're doing really bad," she says. When I was hired at the temp agency, I signed something acknowledging that anyone who leaves without at least a week's notice, whether because they're journalists like me, who will just leave, or because they miss a day for having a baby and are terminated, has their hours paid out not at their hired rate, which for me was 11-something an hour, but at the legal minimum, which in this state is about $7 an hour. In my 10-and-a-half-hour day, I'll make about $60 after taxes. And I'm working for a gigantic, immensely profitable company. The stuff we order from big online retailers lives in large warehouses, owned and operated by the retailers themselves or by third-party logistics contractors. Either way, the actual stuff is often handled by people working for yet another company, a temporary staffing agency like the one that hired me, along with 4,000 other drones for this single amalgamated warehouse between October and December. Temp agencies keep the stink of unacceptable labor conditions off the companies whose names you know. When temps working at a Walmart warehouse sued for not getting paid for all their hours and for then getting sent home without pay for complaining, Walmart, not technically their employer, wasn't named as a defendant. Temporary staffers aren't legally entitled to decent health care because they are just short-term contractors, no matter how long they keep the same job. They aren't entitled to raises either, and they don't get vacation, and they'd have a hell of a time unionizing, and they don't have the privilege of knowing if they'll have work on a particular day or for how long they'll have a job. And that is how you slash prices and deliver products super fast and offer free shipping and still post profits in the millions or billions. "This really doesn't have to be this awful," I say to a friend, "but it is. And this job is just about the only game in town, like it is in lots of towns, and eventually will be in more towns, with U.S. Internet retail sales projected to grow 10% every year to $279 billion in 2015. And with Amazon, the largest of the online retailers, seeing revenues rise 30 to 40% year after year, and already having 69 giant warehouses, 17 of which came online in 2011 alone. So, butch up, Sally. It's my 28th hour as an employee. I probably look happier than I should because I have the extreme luxury of not giving a darn about keeping this job. Nevertheless, I'm tearing around my assigned sector. I'm tearing around my assigned sector hard enough to keep myself consistently lightheaded and a little out of breath. I'm working in books today. Oh, I smile to myself when I reach the paperback shelves. I love being around books. Picking books for Amalgamated has a disadvantage over picking dildos or baby food or Barbies, however. In the book sector, it's cold, and the winter dryness is made worse by the fans and all the paper. I jet across the floor in my rubber-soled Adidas, pant legs whooshing against each other. 30 seconds, according to my scanner, to take 35 steps to get to the right section and row and bend and level and reach for a diary of a wimpy kid. A hot spark shoots between my hand and the metal shelving. It's not the light, static electric prick I would terrorize my sister with when we got bored in carpeted department stores, but a solid shock striking enough to make my body learn to fear it. "Be careful of your head," a co-worker says to me. In the first 2 hours of my day, I picked 300 items. The majority of them zap me painfully. I'm still only at 57% of my goal. It's been 10 years since I was a mover and packer for a moving company, and only slightly less since I worked ridiculously long hours as a waitress and a house cleaner. My back and knees were younger then, but I'm only 31 and feel pretty confident that if I were doing those jobs again, I'd still wake up with soreness like a person who'd worked out too much, not the soreness of a person whose body was staging a revolt. I can break into a goal-meeting suicide pace for short bouts, sure, but I can't keep it up for 10.5 hours. At today's Pickers meeting, we are reminded that customers are waiting. We cannot move at a comfortable pace because we will never make our numbers and customers are not willing to wait. And it's Christmas time. We got 2.7 million orders this week. People need these items, and they need them right now. So even if you've worked here long enough to be granted time off and you're not allowed to use it until the holidays are over. Back in books, I take another sharp shock to my right hand and make some self-righteous promises to myself about continuing to buy food at my more expensive grocery store because I can. Because I'm not actually a person who makes 7.25 an hour, not anymore, not one in three Americans who is now poor or near poor. For the moment, I'm just playing one. Lucky girl, I whisper to myself at the tail of a deep breath. As soon as fresh winter air hits my lungs, it's only lunchtime, but I've breached the warehouse doors without permission. I've picked 500 items this morning, and I don't want to get shocked anymore or hear from the guy with the clipboard what a total disappointment I am. Lucky girl, lucky girl, lucky girl, I repeat on my way to my car. I told the lady from my training group to tell our supervisor not to look for me, and she grabbed my arm as I turned to leave, looking even more worried than usual, asking if I was sure I knew what I was doing. I don't want our supervisor to waste any time. He's got goals to make, too. He won't miss me, and nobody else will either. The temp agency is certainly as full of applicants as it was when I asked to apply for this job. Just look around in here if you want to see how bad it is out there, one of the associates at the temp office said to me, unprompted when I got hired. It's the first time anyone has ever tried to comfort me because I got a job, because he knew and everyone in this industry that's growing wild fast knows and accepts that it's the model that's by design. He offered me the same kind of solidarity the workers inside the warehouse try to provide each other at every break. We're all in the same boat, he said, after shaking my hand to welcome me aboard. It's a really big boat. And that article was from an article in Mother Jones, copyrighted 2012 by the Foundation for National Progress, and it was reprinted with permission. And from the final word, we'll turn to the Talking Point section of the Week magazine. Our first article here is entitled, Gay Marriage, Will Obama's Support Turn the Tide? There's no going back now, said Richard Socarides in NewYorker.com. The struggle for gay civil rights in America may still have a few reels to run, but President Obama's simple statement last week to ABC News, I think that same-sex couples should be able to get married, will surely be remembered as an important symbolic and substantive turning point in the long struggle for equality, and the moment when full marriage rights for all citizens finally become inevitable. Public opinion has been rapidly shifting in favor of gay marriage, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but this was still a bold political gambit for Obama in an election year. It may cost him the votes of some independents, while re-energizing the social conservative base behind Republican Mitt Romney. Ultimately, though, the hope and change president had no choice but to hop off the fence. Gay marriage is a national issue involving the civil rights of millions of Americans, and the president's support represents a historic advance in the nation's long march toward equality and justice. Gay marriage supporters shouldn't congratulate themselves just yet, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. This was also a banner week for opponents of gay marriage, who saw 61% of voters in North Carolina approve a ballot initiative restricting marriage to heterosexual couples. In so doing, North Carolina joined a list of 30 other states that have banned gay marriage. Remember the Equal Rights Amendment and gun control? History is littered with the wreckage of causes pronounced inevitable by all right-thinking people. Gay marriage may have the support of the White House, said USA Today in an editorial, but the idea has yet to catch on where it matters most with voters. Ultimately, this issue is likely to be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, probably when taking on a federal court ruling that California's ban on gay marriage was unconstitutional. Then the opinions that matter most will be those of the 9 justices, not the voters, and not Obama's. The Supreme Court should step in, said Colbert King in the Washington Post. If school desegregation and interracial marriage had been placed on state ballots, they'd still be illegal in many southern states. So how can we put the civil rights of gay and lesbian couples to a majority vote? This is why Obama's statement was disappointing, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. While he said he personally supports same-sex marriage, he also said it was an issue best handled by voters in each state. That's a total cop-out designed to avoid the kind of furious backlash that Roe v. Wade triggered. But just as the U.S. couldn't survive as a mix of free states and slave states, it can't create a system where a couple have the full legal benefits of marriage in one state and lose them when they cross a state border. The courts must recognize what's at stake here: true equality, full citizenship for everyone, and basic human dignity. As a gay married man, I think imposing gay marriage on every state would be a mistake, said Jonathan Rauch in the Washington Post. Public support for gay marriage is steadily growing, but if the Supreme Court were to abruptly overturn all 31 of those statewide bans by a bitterly partisan 5-4 vote, it would just escalate the argument and galvanize the traditionalists. We're already galvanized, said Pat Buchanan in RealClearPolitics.com. By taking up the core cause of anti-Christian secularism, Obama has put the country on notice that if he wins in November and gets to appoint even one more Supreme Court justice, gay marriage will be forced on all of America. Now an election that social conservatives had been struggling to get excited about is shaping up as the antidote of the culture war. We Republicans need to face reality, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. People under 30 simply don't have the same visceral discomfort with same-sex marriage that their parents do. Rather than fight a losing battle, conservatives should try to ensure that when government recognizes gay marriage, there are legal protections in place for those with differing moral beliefs. For the same reason, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com, those of us who believe in same-sex marriage should be wary of overplaying our hand. Far better for the nation to slowly come around to recognizing the justice in marriage equality, state by state, than to have gay marriage imposed by the courts. We're going to win in the end, so we can and should be patient. The next article is entitled Obesity: Why Americans Keep Expanding. Why are Americans so fat and getting fatter with every passing year, said Brian Stelter in the New York Times. 70% of adults in the U.S. are either overweight or obese, and so are one-third of children and teens. This week, HBO began airing a 4-part documentary, The Weight of the Nation, that aims to serve as a wake-up call for an American obesity epidemic. The conventional wisdom about obesity has been wrong, said Gary Taubes in Newsweek. For decades, experts have told Americans we're fat simply because we eat too much and exercise too little. But new research shows that it's not merely how much we eat, but what we're eating that's the problem. Way too much sugar, refined flour in the form of bread, pasta, and pizza, and starches like potatoes. These simple carbohydrates cause insulin to spike, programming the body to retain fat. To reverse the deadly obesity trend, Americans need a new understanding of what constitutes a healthy diet. Ah, the food nannies are back, said Julie Gunlock in NationalReview.com. These scolds have been repeating the same message for years. You're feeble, you're dumb, and you're too busy and addled to take care of your own health. But there's no need for our benevolent government minders to dictate what we eat. Thanks very much. In fact, we fat people are sick of being shamed this way, said Lindy West in Jezebel.com. The bullies now assume they have the right to legislate what people are allowed to eat for their own good or for the children or even because they're gross. But cruel criticism of fat people's diets isn't going to make fat people any less fat. It only makes them more miserable. I know a lot of you don't like our government being involved in our personal lives, said Leslie Marshall in USNews.com. But Americans are quite literally eating themselves to death. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention now predicts that the obesity rate will rise from 36% today to 42% by 2030. A new report from the nonprofit Institute of Medicine recommends that the government respond by heavily taxing sugar-filled sodas and changing farm subsidies to benefit fruit and vegetable growers over corn, wheat, and dairy farmers. The alternative is to do nothing while America becomes the land of the fat and the home of the obese. As we near the end of the program, a couple of short items here. Today, 94% of college students borrow money to pay tuition, double the percentage that needed to borrow two decades ago. Graduates now owe $902 billion in federal student loans and another $140 billion in private loans, a level of debt that leaves many of them unable to buy cars, afford apartments, or move out of their parents' home. And of people who graduated college since 2009, less than half found a job within a year of leaving school. Those who did find work had an average starting salary of $27,000, $3,000 less than the average starting salary for the classes of 2006 and 2007. Economists believe their wages will stay depressed for the next decade. And now let's close with the poll watch. 60% of Americans say President Obama's decision to support gay marriage will not affect their vote. 26% say they'll be less likely to vote for him, while 13% say they'll be more likely to do so. And 61% say the country's obesity problem is caused by people's personal choices about eating and exercising. 19% say food manufacturers and the fast food industry share blame. 49% favor allowing insurers to charge obese people more for health insurance. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.